Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. Tomorrow, Tuesday, will be the 1,000th day since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The question now is whether the course of that grinding, blood-soaked war is about to take a significant turn. It's a question that's been fueled, of course, by the election of Donald Trump, a man keen to kick over what he regards as the old failed consensus. But also, just now, the question is being asked in the context of the reported US decision to allow American long-range missiles to strike targets deep inside Russia. It's a move, a granting of permission, which Ukraine has been pleading for months, years even. And equally, it's a change which the Kremlin is warning will only deepen and possibly widen the conflict. What of the US's Western partners? Well, speaking in Brussels today, the European Union foreign policy chief Josep Borrell struck a forthright tone, saying that he hoped EU member states who supplied this sort of weaponry to Ukraine would now follow the US lead and allow a similar ability to hit Russia.
I've been saying once and again that Ukraine should be able to use the arm we provided to them in order to not only to stop the arrow, but also to be able to hit the Arcus. I continue believing this is what has to be done. I'm sure it will be discussed once again. I hope member states will agree on that.
In a moment, we'll try to assess how tactically significant this change could be. But before we do that, let's get a sense of how this new US permissiveness is being seen in Moscow. Maria Butina is an MP with the governing United Russia Party.
I don't think that the world today needs another escalation or another step to the potentially starting the Third World War. And while the United States is playing their little games in politics, they actually push the world to a very dangerous red line. And now I see just one guy going crazy and his people going crazy just because they lost the elections. So that's nothing to do with Russia, actually. This is the revenge to Trump, and this is an attempt to escalate as much as possible so Trump is not able to keep the promise to stop the war. But that's stupid.
Well, if you say that it takes the world closer to World War III, what in that case do you think the Russian response will be or should be?
Well, Russians don't speculate. Russians do respond. Which means that our president has been telling that if you guys cross certain red lines, we're going to defend ourselves.
But so Maria, sorry to interrupt, but I mean, there have been promises that red lines are about to be crossed been crossed many, many times. I mean, it happened with the deployment of tanks. It happened with the deployment of other types of weaponry. And I mean, to be blunt, World War III has not yet happened.
Okay. Well, in your words, I can hear that you probably wish it to happen. I hope it's not so and I'm mistaken here. But anyway, this is indeed the issue between Russia and Ukraine. And the U.S. shall not teach and preach what should Ukraine think or Russia should think. This is just not their business. They're on the other continent, and I view our country deeply touched and in a close, possibly, hopefully, someday in union with Europe, because this is our land. That's not their land. And now we're letting them guys in their dirty shoes to step into our land to steal our people, our manufacturing, our philosophy, our people, and everything we have.
Maria, with the greatest respect, it's not your land, though. I mean, it's an internationally recognized border, and paragraph 4, article 2 of the founding charter of the United Nations says all members shall refrain from the use of force against the territorial integrity of any state. I mean, you can say you have reason, but by whatever measure, that is something that Russia did.
How about Israel and Palestine then?
Well, I'm not
How
talking about
even
Israel and Palestine. I'm talking
land.
About Russia and Ukraine.
Well, I am talking about the whole world that is now, because of the United States, lost the ability to negotiate because nobody now follows international agreements. This is what I don't like specifically, because I remember the Nation League that was simply lost because the countries couldn't sit and talk. And what I see now, we are going the same direction. And the last time we didn't end well. And I'm very much hopeful that this time we can stop, think, for in the sake of the future of our children and the human being, just to stop the conflicts wherever they are.
Maria Butina, an MP with the governing United Russia Party, speaking to us from Moscow. Moscow is also where Steve Rosenberg is, our Russia editor for the BBC. Steve, what's your sense of how significant this decision is being viewed as in Moscow?
Oh, it's an interesting question. I mean, you know, the national symbol of Russia is the double-headed eagle, and the reaction here is kind of like a double-headed eagle. On the one hand, you have newspapers, you have Russian politicians absolutely furious, spitting blood almost, that the president of the United States could take such a decision. On the other hand, I've also heard military experts here and some newspapers saying nothing to worry about. Russia has managed to shoot down to intercept these long-range missiles before in Russian-occupied Ukraine and will do so again, as if they're trying to calm down the Russian public and say there's nothing to worry about. So you've got this sort of double reaction here, which leaves the main question, Tim, really. How is Vladimir Putin going to respond? He's made it clear over the last few months, he signalled very clearly that this is another red line for him, that if Europe or America gives permission to Ukraine to use their long-range missiles to strike deep into Russia, then he will consider that to be the direct participation of NATO countries in the war in Ukraine, basically NATO countries fighting Russia. He has spelled that out pretty clearly. Well, now that President Biden has taken this decision. So how is Vladimir Putin going to respond? That's going to be the fascinating thing to see over the next few weeks.
Very interesting, because it almost suggests that as significant as the military implications of this decision are the political ones. And am I right in thinking, Steve, that what you're suggesting is that actually this potentially puts Mr. Putin in a position where people in Russia will be looking at him rather quizzically?
Possibly. But keep in mind, you know, the Kremlin controls the media landscape almost completely here. So it controls the narrative and it can spin things as it sees fit. But, you know, going back over the last few months, Vladimir Putin has suggested at times that he may respond to such a development by arming Western adversaries. Right, in order that they can strike Western targets. He has spelled that out. And that is something that Alexander Lukashenko, the leader of Belarus, basically confirmed to me a couple of weeks ago in an interview. But on the other hand, Vladimir Putin knows that in 2 months' time, Joe Biden will be out of office, and Donald Trump will be in the White House, a man who has praised Vladimir Putin, called him smart, someone who seems to admire Vladimir Putin, someone who has said in the past he wants to build a better relationship with Russia and with Vladimir Putin, and someone who has voiced his skepticism about continuing US military assistance for Ukraine. That's going to happen in 2 months' time. So what does Vladimir Putin do? Does he go for another escalation based upon what Joe Biden has decided? Or does he wait until Donald Trump comes into office? A Russian newspaper today suggested that once Donald Trump comes into the White House, he might, quote, revise Joe Biden's decision on these long-range missiles.
Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor in Moscow, thank you very much. Shashank Joshi is defense editor of The Economist, joins us now. Shashank, very good to have you back on the program. How militarily significant is this ability now of Ukraine to use these ATACMS, these longer-range missiles, into Russia?
Well, first of all, it depends on where they're used. And the initial indications are they may be confined to Kursk province. If you look at where Kursk is on a map, you can see that it's important. But actually, there are many, many Russian military targets all along that stretch of front line, north to south, all right down to the Black Sea, in fact, which wouldn't be covered by that. So is Ukraine allowed to hit those? I think we need to know the answer to that first. Moreover, these are not going to have an immediate overnight effect on the front lines. There are many reasons for that. One of them is that Russia, if you look at the Russian attacks, are occurring in very, very small infantry groups. You know, these are not big battalions battalions and brigades storming over the plains like a Cold War piece of, you know, Tom Clancy novel. These are really small groups, packets of Russian soldiers. They're not dependent on big logistical trains that can be disrupted by strikes on the rear. However, with all that said, if you take out Russian ammunition, if you take out Russian command, if you hit North Korean barracks, of course you are going to slowly sap Russia's military strength and increase the pace of attrition. And in a war of attrition, that really is important.
Presumably, though, Russia has had time. I mean, it's been so long coming, this permission, that presumably Russia has had time to withdraw and fortify.
It has, because let's remember here, Ukraine has got ATACMS and it has been using ATACMS. It's just been using them inside Ukraine. It's been using them in occupied Crimea, other parts of Russian occupied territory to very good effect for about, I think, over a year now. And so Russian air defenses have had time to learn their incoming trajectories, to learn their electronic signatures and how you might jam them, learn the preparations associated with their use. So there's a lot of adaptation, not least because people think this will help with the Russian aircraft carrying glide bombs. It won't, because those aircraft have, almost all of them have mostly moved east, out of range. It will help with other things, but not with those aircraft. And I think if we're going to do this, if the White House is going to do this, it just would be a continued absurdity to do this drip of saying, go on, use a few in Kursk, use a few here, use a few there. It just doesn't make any sense anymore. They've got to really use them across the front effectively, and they should indeed have done so without a public announcement, but we are where we are.
Yeah. Well, in that case, do you think this then pressurizes Britain and France to allow their longer-range missiles to be used deep inside Russia?
I'm not sure it pressurizes them so much as gives them the opportunity to do what they would probably have wanted to do anyway. We know that the UK government had been exploring this option, discussing it, deliberating over it, and we know there were reasons why it hadn't done it, partly to do with dependence on American technology and intelligence for the way some of these things are fired, but also to do, presumably, with a degree of diplomatic and military cover, in other words, safety in numbers. So now that Biden has made this step, I would expect a change in policy and to allow Ukraine to fire British and French ones into Russia. I don't anticipate a big fanfare or public announcement at a lectern announcing this. I would imagine the first we learn of this will be strikes inside Russia. I would think they are coming, though.
Shashank Joshi, defence editor of The Economist, thank you very much for joining us. We'll hope to be getting a view from a very seasoned former US diplomat with a lot of experience of the region in about 15 minutes here on NewsHour. And of course, you can get the latest updates on our website, bbc.com/news. There's a live page there on the Kremlin's furious response to Biden's decision to allow US missiles to be fired deep inside Russia. Also coming up on the programme, the remarkable story of the hundreds of British prisoners of war saved from drowning by Chinese fishermen.
Once the fishermen had discovered what was going on, the village elders organised a full rescue mission, and every man on the island who had a boat took it out and went again and again and again to rescue as many as they could. And they rescued a total of 384.
It's a story we will hear retold in about 25 minutes. Our headlines this hour, as we've been hearing, the Kremlin has said that Washington's decision to allow Ukraine to use US missiles to strike deep into Russia is adding fuel to the flames. And construction work on the last part of a huge pipeline sending Russian gas to China has been completed. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Tim Franks. Delhi continues to gasp under its blanket of toxic smog. In fact, the air quality appears only to be worsening. Most schools in the Indian capital have moved their classes online until further notice. Office staff are being encouraged to work from home. The pollution has surged past 60 times the World Health Organization's daily recommended maximum. I've been speaking to Ananya Mahajan from the Sustainable Futures Collaborative. It's a think tank in Delhi. She's been telling me what it's like just trying to move around the city at the moment.
Delhi is quite hazy at the moment and it feels weirdly apocalyptic. The temperatures have dropped substantially since the pollution levels got higher and the visibility is quite poor.
How are people's daily lives being impacted? I mean, it must be so unpleasant to be living through this?
Yes, for sure. You know, just today, in fact, it was announced that most school classes have been shifted online. So that is definitely hampering children's education. The second is there have been very, very large number of delays in flights and trains and such because of the low visibility. Thirdly, of course, there are very, very serious sort of health concerns surrounding, you know, exposure to such high levels of air pollution, even if it is, you know, for a short duration. People definitely, you know, need to be sort of minimizing the time they spend outdoors, and sort of the physical exertion also needs to be minimized.
Well, as you say, I mean, this is your focus of work. I mean, for people like you, what must be particularly frustrating is that not only is this stuff incredibly bad for everybody, but particularly for those who are vulnerable, but it's also just quite predictable, isn't it? That when winter rolls around, when the temperature drops at this time of year in Delhi, the pollution goes off the scale. Why do you think the Indian capital cannot avoid this happening?
Air pollution, especially in Delhi, is a year-round problem. We usually have air quality levels which exceed safe limits throughout the year, except there are certain seasons, such as the monsoon when it rains, so the air does clean up then. But yes, it is particularly bad at this time of the year. It does happen every year, and a lot of it is attributable to the meteorological conditions at this time of year, when, you know, the air is denser because of the cooler temperatures, and also the wind conditions aren't very supportive, so the air is sort of more stagnant than usual. But that being said, it's also that Delhi lies in a region which is part of a much larger airshed. So it's not just susceptible to sources of pollution within the city, but it is also susceptible to, you know, transboundary pollution, which is pollution that comes into the city from other parts of the country.
I'm sure there are no easy solutions, but what do you think are the priorities that people in Delhi, maybe the authorities within Delhi, should do in order to try and improve this?
I think definitely number one should be stricter norms around emissions from power plants and energy plants. There have been orders which have been passed to sort of have cleaner emissions from, say, thermal power plants, but, you know, due to cost concerns, these haven't exactly been enforced. The second is, of course, the enhancement of the public transport system in Delhi. We already do have a good public transport system, but for the sheer number of people in the city, we do really need to have a much more enhanced public transport system. And the third thing is, of course, a lot more political participation from the people, making themselves more aware about the problem, but also sort of holding local authorities accountable, because it sort of has to be a very coordinated, cross-sectoral, cross-classes kind of problem. That kind of effort needs to be there for this issue to actually get resolved.
Ananya Mahajan speaking to me from a very smoggy Delhi. British wildlife organisations say that the slender-billed curlew, a species of wading bird once found around the world, is now extinct. It's the first known global bird extinction from mainland Europe, North Africa and West Asia. The bird was last spotted for certain in Morocco about 30 years ago. Alex Bond is the curator in charge of birds at London's Natural History Museum and a co-author of the research.
Every species, of course, is unique. The slender-billed curlew was about a foot tall. It's a large wading bird that would breed in wetlands and winter along the coasts. And it had a fantastically long bill that curved down that helped it probe in the pools for little invertebrates to eat. A really just gorgeous bird.
And it hasn't actually been spotted for many years, I was reading.
That's right. The last confirmed sighting was 1995, the wintering grounds in Morocco. So there hasn't been a sighting now in about 30 years.
What has now driven you and your colleagues to the point where you think, actually, we can say with pretty much iron certainty that actually the slender-billed curlew is extinct?
So the chance of it existing today is smaller than the chance of you being hit by lightning during this interview. What we did was we compiled about 1,200 records, and that's sightings, photographs, and museum specimens going back to the mid-19th century. About two-thirds of those we were able to verify were slender-billed curlews. We can put those into a model that estimates the probability that the bird exists today. So you have something like a sighting, which is, you know, oh, I saw a slender-billed curlew out on my farm last week. Well, nobody else knows that. We can't go back and look. You might have confused it for something else, or you could have just made it up. You've got photographs, which are all right, but they're only a 2D representation. You can't interrogate them further. You have the photo and that's it. And then you have museum specimens, which are sort of the gold standard because you can look at it, you can hold it, you can see, ah, that's where the black is on the underside of the wing. And you can be absolutely certain. You put all these in a model with these different levels of certainty, and it estimates the probability that the bird still exists today, combined with surveys that have been done on the breeding and wintering grounds since that 1995 sighting that you mentioned. And we're pretty sure that, unfortunately, they're gone.
Do you understand why?
It's a combination of two things. One is hunting. So they were hunted on migration. They would breed in Kazakhstan and southern Russia, migrate over the Ural Mountains through Europe and winter in North Africa. And as a sort of a large wading migratory bird, they're going to be pretty tasty. You could purchase them at markets in Europe in the 19th and early 20th centuries. By the 20th century, they were noted as being not terribly common. And then probably land use change, conversion of wetlands to arable crop fields in the Soviet Union. And the legacies of that was probably what ultimately drove them over the brink.
Am I right in saying that it's quite unusual for a bird to be declared extinct in Europe?
Well, Tim, you're exactly right. This is the first official bird extinction in Europe in 500 years, mainland Europe. But the important thing to remember is that in that same 500 years globally, we've lost 200 other bird species. And today, there's 1,400 species that are globally threatened with extinction. So the slender-billed curlew may feel like a unique case for us, especially in Europe. But unfortunately, it's the norm for what birds are experiencing in the world today.
Alex Bonn from London's Natural History Museum on the extinction of the slender-billed curlew. Just to let you know that in 30 minutes... In fact, just under 30 minutes, we've got a remarkable interview with an 87-year-old veteran of Britain's atomic weapons tests. It's all because of a new BBC documentary, which is due to be broadcast on Wednesday, investigating the events and their aftermath.
This is the longest-running scandal in British history. There is nothing bigger or worse than what's happened to the nuclear veterans.
In the heart of the atom's destructive power, there lay the antidote to the threat of war, the great deterrent.
By 75 seconds.
The world doesn't know. I've been fighting this battle for 63 years.
The British state have gaslighted these men.
We thought we were going to die.
We'll hear from one of those veterans, as I say, in just over 20 minutes, here on NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. Now, once I've got my script sorted out, health authorities in the Central African Republic say that Mpox cases are now five times higher than usual. The virus has been common in rural areas for years, but it's now spreading faster in busy cities like the capital, Bangui. The BBC's Dorcas Wangira reports on how local organisations are trying to bolster their efforts to stop the spread and fight misinformation.
Meet 55-year-old Chalman Lombay. He's the president of the Union of the Blind in the Central African Republic. He's also the host of Acres for the Disabled, a community radio show aimed at people living with disability like himself.
It is often said that radio is a friend of the blind. Radio is listened to more in the Central African Republic, and it is very easy for disabled people to get a radio.
A UNICEF poll conducted in the Central African Republic found that 62% of people trust radio as their most reliable source for information on Mpox. Since the Central African Republic declared a national Mpox outbreak in July, Chalman has shifted the focus of his show to raising awareness around Mpox.
Because we've had training on Mpox, we are well equipped to inform others. In my program, I explain how the virus spreads, the signs of infection, and how to avoid being infected.
Mpox is endemic in the Central African Republic, but this year it was reported in the capital, Bangui, for the first time, prompting health authorities to declare national outbreak. Data from the World Health Organization shows that two people have died of the total 64 confirmed Mpox cases registered this year. In an effort to help people avoid the disease, community workers are spreading crucial health messages.
I often advise people in my neighborhood that Mpox is very dangerous.
Diane Makavo-Anel-Jocelyn is a community health worker in Gitangola 2, a neighborhood of the capital city. But not everyone is receptive to her message. Some people still cling to commonly held beliefs about the disease.
Sometimes others tell me that I'm lying and that this disease has always existed, that all you have to do is wash yourself with cassava leaves without going to the hospital.
The use of traditional methods can sometimes make the situation worse. Dr. Pierre Somse is the health minister of the Central African Republic.
The cases that have been observed have reported that the use of these treatments has resulted in the lesions of the rash becoming more widespread and the condition of the patients worsening.
The vast majority of Mpox cases have been registered in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which shares the Central African Republic's longest border. The possibility of cross-border transmission has authorities here on high alert.
And that was Dorcas Wangira reporting from Bangui in the Central African Republic. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks. And back to our top story now, the decision by the US. It hasn't been officially announced, but it's been very widely reported that Ukraine will now be authorized to use American long-range missiles to hit targets deep inside Russia. There's been a strong reaction out of Moscow. We brought you a flavour of the anger with our interview with the Russian MP Maria Butina earlier. What's the view of a former senior US diplomat with wide experience of the region? Kurt Volker was the US Special Representative for Ukraine negotiations in the first Trump administration. He's also a former US ambassador to NATO. Mr. Volker, very good to have you back on NewsHour. Why do you think President Biden has made this move now?
Well, thanks, Tim, and great to be with you. It's a move that is reversing a policy that should never have been taken, a policy decision that should never have been taken to begin with. International law says a country has a right to defend itself. And to, under the laws of armed conflict, to restrict one's targets to military targets. That's all the U.S. ever should have said. By creating this issue of how long range they send, we've now given everybody some kind of debating point whether this is appropriate or not. It's something that should never have come up, and it's good that it's finally put back in the box.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you make that point about the debating point, because that was part of what Maria Butina, the United Russia MP, had to say to us earlier on, which was, look, this is just about domestic political calculations inside the US. It's there to try and, frankly, to shaft President Trump before he comes into office. Do you think there's any validity to that?
No, I don't, actually. I think it helps President Trump. What President Trump wants to do is to push for a peace as soon as possible. And he said that it needs to be a fair peace. Because Putin is attacking Ukraine and will continue to attack Ukraine, the only way to get that is to convince Putin that it's going to be too costly for him if he persists. So you got to show strength in order to achieve peace, peace through strength. And you, this will actually help that situation on the ground.
Well, and you certainly have one person who's due to come into the new administration who seems to espouse that argument. That's Michael Waltz, Mr. Trump's pick for National Security Advisor. On the other hand, you have people like J.D. Vance, the vice president, saying, I mean, he hasn't specifically come out against this, but he has said, look, America should pull back because Ukraine is not really our argument. Ukraine should cede captured land. It should be told it can never join NATO. You've got Don Jr., who is a significant voice in the president's president-elect's ear, saying this is the military-industrial complex gone mad. They're trying to bring on World War III. So there are competing voices for Mr. Trump's attention, aren't there?
Well, that may be, but you just have to look at what Russia did on Sunday. They launched these massive missile strikes against the electricity system and the heating system in Ukraine, just as the weather is turning colder in order to impose as much suffering on the people as possible. What President Trump has said that he wants to do is to stop that, to end that. But the only way to do that is to convince Putin to stop. And that's going to require putting more capability on the table so he can see that there's no victory for Russia in sight. And he's actually only hurting Russia. So these sort of things are not about a military-industrial complex or anything else. It's about helping Ukraine survive and ending the war.
Would you expect now for European allies of Ukraine to follow suit when thinking, for example, about the French Scalp missiles, British Storm Shadow? Do you think that in combination with this new license to use attackums inside Russia, could make a difference?
Well, first off, I think they will follow suit. Indeed, the reason that some of the countries that you mentioned had not been providing authorization for long-range use is because the U.S. was denying them the ability to do so with goods that are including technology licensed from the U.S. So we were not authorizing that use for our allies to authorize it. So that should now go away. I do think that many of them, UK in particular, and France as well, possibly even Germany, will now go along and do the same thing. And yes, I do think it will make a difference. It's not going to be a game changer. It's not going to end the war in a day. But it will cause Russia to change the way that it is deploying and using its forces in its attacks against Ukraine. They're now going to be under greater risk of an immediate counterattack when they launch aircraft or when they launch missiles. And so this is something the Russians are going to have to think about.
Kurt Volker, former U.S. ambassador to NATO, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Just before the end of the programme, we'll be hearing about calls for a proper accounting for something that happened in the wake of World War II. But before that, a new film documentary is recounting an extraordinary incident from the Second World War. It was when Chinese fishermen saved hundreds of British prisoners of war from drowning. In 1942, a Japanese ship moving around 1,800 British troops from Hong Kong to Japan as forced labour, that ship was hit by a torpedo and it sank. What followed is told in the film Made in China, for which there are now Oscar hopes. Vincent Dowd reports.
When Japan invaded Britain's colony of Hong Kong at the end of 1941, newsreels at home tried to sound positive.
On the outbreak of hostilities, this easternmost outpost of the British Empire instantly rejected the Japanese ultimatum to surrender and girded itself to fight the invaders. Beleaguered Hong Kong straightway suffered the full fury of powerful land, sea and air forces and hit back.
But Japan's much bigger land, sea and air forces were victorious. After a year in captivity, 1,800 UK troops were sent in hideous conditions on the freighter the Lisbon Maru to become Japanese slave labour. The ship was torpedoed by a US submarine whose commander was unaware who was on board. Brian Finch is advisor to the new Chinese documentary, The Sinking of the Lisbon Maru.
It took some 24 hours for the ship to sink. During this period, the Japanese sent a rescue fleet, which lifted off all the Japanese troops who were on board and most of the crew of the ship, leaving the prisoners below deck. They also battened down the hatches to make sure the prisoners couldn't get out.
The Japanese were sentencing them to death, really.
More or less.
At the last moment, many of the POWs were able to escape and jump into the water. The film tracked down the final two survivors at the end of their lives, Dennis Morley and William Benningfield. In the film, their testimony is used with animated reconstructions.
Once you see Mum dead body, I mean, you become hardened to it. And I thought, my God, after what I've been through, is this the way I'm going to die? Target practice.
So I said, the heck with you guys, I'll go the other way.
But what makes this story different is that a couple of miles away on a Chinese island, fishing families had become aware of the unfolding disaster at sea.
Once the fishermen had discovered what was going on, the village elders organised a full rescue mission and every man, on the island who had a boat, took it out, and went again and again and again to rescue as many as they could. And they rescued a total of 384.
William Benningfield and Dennis Morley were among those astounded to find themselves pulled out of the water to safety.
And suddenly this light came on me.
I was swimming towards the island and I could see the rocks. And I thought to myself, how the hell am I going to get on those rocks? And the next thing I know, there's a little boat there.
I'll never forget this voice. This Chinese voice said, "Hello, I saved you." And it was a Chinese fisherman from the islands I was trying to make to.
All I know is he was kind.
And he gave me some raw fish to eat and water to drink.
The next day, the survivors were rounded up again by the Japanese, except for three men who escaped back to England. Fang Li is known in China as a producer of feature films. He encountered this real-life story and decided to memorialise those who died, about 800 men, as well as the courage and humanity of the Chinese fishermen.
If you go to that island, people have a very strong tradition of hospitality. Whoever in the water, no matter it's an enemy or friend, they will pick up. Many families have their loved ones lost at the sea.
One of the producers of that film ending, the report from Vincent Dowd. Now, has Elon Musk's social media platform X got a big new competitor? It's a question that's often been asked in recent years, but this time more people seem to think so. It comes in the form of a platform called Blue Sky. It is growing rapidly, and it is currently picking up about 1 million new signups a day. So is this the site to rival X? And with no ads, what's its business model? James Titcomb is technology editor of Britain's Daily Telegraph newspaper. He's also a Blue Sky user, and he's been speaking to Sean Farrington.
Blue Sky is really picking up momentum at the moment. Anyone who's on it, who's using it and used to use Twitter, knows that it just has started to get that community feel people remember from Twitter's early days, if you were on there 10 years ago.
How is it different to what X and Elon Musk's social media feed provides?
Blue Sky is not so different from X. You post these short messages, you can post videos. When you open the app, you see this feed of short messages from people. It does look a lot more like Twitter used to several years ago than X does now, in that the main feed is this reverse timeline rather than this algorithmically generated pro-engagement feed. The main difference is there is a lot of frustration at X. People feel that the platform has become very dominated by Elon Musk, and it's come to incentivize engagement. A lot of people think the platform has become very right-wing or very pro-Trump, especially in recent weeks. And I think the shift to Blue Sky is effectively a reaction against that.
Who are Blue Sky? How is it making money and being able to provide this platform for so many people joining?
Blue Sky was actually founded within Twitter and then was spun out when Elon Musk bought Twitter and renamed it X. It's only got about 20 employees now, and it's run technically as a public benefit corporation, which means it's not supposed to be as incentivized on profit as many people are. So it's relatively small still compared to some of the major social media networks. So it doesn't cost that much to run. But as you say, it doesn't have advertising right now. It doesn't necessarily make a lot of money. I think that is going to be a question in the future. There are some little things that they're looking at, but it does remain to be seen how they are going to keep the lights on.
Does that make it more vulnerable? We talk so much about social media sites needing to do more to protect users. I mean, has Blue Sky got the capacity to do that?
Yeah, it's a really big question as the site gets bigger. Right now, if you're a bot or looking to influence people's thoughts or elections or whatever, Blue Sky isn't really worth your trouble because there aren't the grounds for the people on there. There's about 18 million people on there compared to 250 million on X. I think if the momentum continues to grow, they really are going to have a problem. They're going to have to make these investments. We've seen this with every social media company that gets bigger.
And that was James Titcomb from the Daily Telegraph speaking to Sean Farrington. You're listening to NewsHour. And And a reminder of our top story this hour. The Kremlin has said that Washington's decision to allow Ukraine to use US missiles to strike deep into Russia is adding fuel to the flames. Speaking to this program, our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg outlined the options for the Russian president.
So what does Vladimir Putin do? Does he go for another escalation based upon what Joe Biden has decided? Or does he wait until Donald Trump comes into office? One Russian newspaper today suggested that once Donald Trump comes into the White House, he might, quote, revise Joe Biden's decision on these long-range missiles.
A couple of other headlines, as we've been hearing, as toxic smog continues to blanket Delhi. India's Supreme Court has criticised the city's authorities for failing to take action sooner. And a trial has opened in Turkey in which people are accused of moving babies to different hospitals for profit. At least 10 children died. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service. And back to that story I mentioned earlier, the period over the 1950s and 60s when almost 40,000 British and Commonwealth servicemen witnessed dozens of atomic and hydrogen bomb tests and hundreds of radioactive experiments. It led to many of them developing debilitating health conditions which have blighted their lives for decades. And now the few who are still alive are demanding that the British government fully open up about what was known and when, and indeed whether they were deliberately put in harm's way to test the effects of atomic weaponry. I've been speaking to one of the veterans, 87-year-old John Morris.
I was 18 and I was called up to do national service. I lived in a little village called Little Eva, which is just outside Bolton. And then I finished up at Christmas Island, which is in the middle of the Pacific. This was in 1956. I sailed from Liverpool, went to Jamaica. That was our first stop. We then sailed to Panama, went through the Panama Canal, which was absolutely unbelievable. And then finished up on Hawaii, at Waikiki Beach.
Tell me what happened then when you got to Christmas Island.
Well, we were the front runners. We were setting up a base camp for, as we were told, to build or help build an airport, a runway. One morning, we were ordered to get dressed, go on parade and go and sit on an open space, and a plane would be going, dropping a bomb. That's as much as we were told and what we knew. We had a pair of shorts, a hat on, and a coat. And we watched the plane do its figure of eight, and then we were ordered to sit with our backs to the explosion and follow orders. The next thing I knew, and this will, I'll try and demonstrate to the listeners reasonably well, the flash that came was so bright, you could literally see the sinews and the blood in your hands. And it was so bizarre and so frightening that you didn't know what you'd actually witnessed. And then the heat came. I don't know if you've ever put an oven on a very high heat and you've opened the door and you've gone, God, that's hot. To say that heat was 1,000 times greater, I don't think I would be exaggerating. Your back cringed from the heat. The only way I knew about atomic tests was obviously Nagasaki and Hiroshima, but the bomb I witnessed, according to all the records, was probably 100 times greater. But nobody, the MOD, nobody warned us.
The MOD being the Ministry of Defence here in the United Kingdom. When did you start feeling unwell?
I started to feel unwell when I was about 28.
A considerable time later.
Yes. This is where we have been unable in many ways to fight any sort of criminal act because we were out of time.
If you don't mind as well, John, just explain what happened with your son.
Well, basically, we got married, and we had a son 2 years later, 24, and everything, as far as we knew, was going along nicely. One morning, we woke up and my son was dead in his cot. He was 4 months old, and that was so unbelievable that morning. My wife jumped out of bed, screamed, and ran immediately downstairs. We didn't have a phone. She had to run up to a phone box, and I was trying to give my son the kiss of life. The ambulance came. We took him to hospital. He was pronounced dead at the hospital. And then we got the death certificate several days later, and that said that he died of bronchial pneumonia. And it took me 50 years to get the autopsy report. And when that autopsy report came, it said that his lungs had not formed correctly.
Right.
And that is when I started to have suspicions. I wondered if it was anything to do with the atomic explosion. And then about age 26, I was as fit as a butcher's dog. I used to play football. I played football for the army. And I was feeling extremely tired. I went to see the doctor, and the doctor said, "You have got a blood deficiency and we need to give you B12 injections immediately." And I've been having B12 injections for more than 60 years.
So, John, your case now that you and other veterans are bringing against the British government, it's not just about what happened to you back in the 1950s, but it's also, am I right in saying it's also that you are saying that since then, British government departments have willfully covered up the evidence, that they knew more about the possible dangers at the time than they let on? Is that right?
That's perfectly correct, because there is in the public domain a letter from Clement Attlee, who was the Prime Minister at the time. He wrote, "We need to test men, equipment and materials against a nuclear explosion." And that's why we call ourselves the human guinea pigs for this British government to become a nuclear power. We were used, abused, and even today they deny, the MOD deny that. I had a broken arm that took twice as long to heal as normal, and I've also had cancer. Unfortunately, my cancers and my problems do not fit the criteria that the MOD have laid down, which is so very, very narrow. If I'd have had leukemia, I would have had a pension. Every country, including Russia, have paid compensation to their veterans in relation to nuclear weapons, apart from one, and that's England. All I want as a veteran, I've been fighting this for 60 years.
And that was John Morris, one of Britain's nuclear test veterans. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.